certainly is an encouraging welcome that Freddie gives, and noticing that the attendance is down and blames it immediately on me. Between that and the good brother in the back that mistook me for Dennis Allen, between those two comments, I'm not really sure what you mean. I am thankful to be with you, good brethren, again, and to have this opportunity to talk to you about a little bit about the Brazil work, and then to look at God's Word and hopefully make some points and some lessons from the Scriptures that will benefit us this evening. Before I begin, I want to talk a little bit about the work in Brazil and what we plan to do, realizing that there would be some people that are visiting here or perhaps others that weren't here the last time that I have to be coming through Athens. Some of this will be repetitious for some of you, but for the sake of everyone, I'll just go ahead and kind of back up and mention a few things. My family and I have lived in Brazil twice before, once in 94 and 95, and then again in 98 to 2000. And so we are planning to move back to Brazil, Lord willing, this summer. That's about as much as we can narrow it down at this point. Hopefully by late July, we will be able to leave. We're waiting on our visas to be approved. We've applied for them. And the favorite Brazilian pastime is waiting. And so we're just simply waiting for the approval process of those visas. And once those are approved, we look to move to the city of João Pessoa. I'm not sure how clear that's going to be. I've tried to work a little bit with the circles there. But the city of João Pessoa is the easternmost city in the Americas. If you were to look at a map, perhaps at home, and look at the country of Brazil, it juts out into the Atlantic Ocean on the northern part near the equator, and the very most eastern city is the city of João Pessoa. That's where my family and I hope to move this summer, Lord willing, and work with the church that is located there. Just as far as a little bit of information. We lived before in the city of Sao Paulo. Those of you, and many of you, are familiar with the work that has gone on there, both from Gary Fisher having lived there, Dennis Allen and his family still living in that area, Tim and Lori living there, and others that the group here at Athens has helped to support in numerous ways. When we lived in Sao Paulo before, that was an experience. And then going up to the city of João Pessoa, we're talking nearly 1,400 miles to the north of where Dennis and Benita currently live. And so we will not have, unfortunately, a lot of opportunities to work together closely with them. Although we're going to be in the same country, it would almost be like somebody working in the state of Alabama and somebody else in Utah or something like that, and probably not crossing paths very much. But in addition to, while I had the map up, I wanted to point out a couple of other cities for your sake, and that is the city of Rio de Janeiro and the city of Fortaleza. Again, I'm not sure how clear those are. Rio de Janeiro is just a little bit north of Sao Paulo, and Fortaleza is north of João Pessoa there. And those two cities, new congregations have gotten started in both of those cities within about the last 4 months or so. If you've had the opportunities to read any of Dennis Allen's reports, you would be familiar perhaps with those two new works that are going on there. Very exciting things are happening in Brazil, as they have for many years now. And there just seems to be new opportunities all the time. But in connection with the work in João Pessoa, while we're waiting on our visas to be approved, we hope to move there by the end of July, as I stated. And some people have asked about some of our living conditions and so forth, and this is the house that we have picked out to live in. No, it's not really. But sometimes when we talk about Brazil, this is what people have in mind. They think of the rainforest and of Indian huts and things like that. And this picture was taken in Brazil near the rainforest, near the Amazons, on a trip that I made in that area several years ago. But that's not where we plan to move to. The city of João Pessoa is a rather industrious city. It's developed nicely. This is a couple of postcard pictures of the downtown area. We'll be living about 25 minutes from where these pictures were taken. But one thing that was a great consolation for my family was in the far left-hand corner, the upper left-hand corner, you see a picture of McDonald's, the Golden arches are there. And so that helped my family, to my children, to be able to accept the fact that we were going to be moving to Brazil. At least there are some McDonald's in the city. It's a city of about 250,000 people, and just tremendous opportunities there to be a part of the work. The church only has about 25 members in the congregation. Here's a picture of them in a worship service, a picture taken. It's a couple of years old, that picture is. I'm always nervous about whenever we go to Brazil and I make these trips. I kind of feel like I'm treating the brethren there like they're in a zoo or something, because I'm always wanting to take pictures of them to bring back and talk about the work that's going on there. But I haven't done that the last couple of trips, so these pictures are a little bit old. But they do give you an impression of what the work is going to be like. The church meets in a carport of one of the Christians' houses there in João Pessoa. Here you see it's engaged in the worship service. There's also regular Bible studies, just like you might have here, with the exception of the Saturday morning Bible study only having a few members. This is really just about all of the men in the congregation would meet there. And one of the nice things about having a small congregation is that nobody gets lost. Nobody gets left out, whether they want to or not. If you don't show up, then it's going to be rather obvious, and we're going to be able to find out if there's anything wrong or anything that we can help with. So the work is small, but there's good men that are anxious and wanting to be a part of spreading the gospel there. This is the nucleus of the congregation. The fellow on the far right is not a member of Luis's family, but would be happy to be that. That's a picture of me. But Luis is the gentleman that's in the back, and right in front of the chalkboard with the glasses on. And he has five children, three sons who have obeyed the gospel. They're the three boys on your far left. I guess it is. I keep wanting to say the opposite direction. But on your left, the three young men there have obeyed the gospel. Two of them have married, and their wives have also obeyed the gospel. And so this family makes up the majority of the congregation, along with a couple of extended members of their family, as well as some other people that have been converted in the community. But I wanted to at least give you a glimpse, a couple of pictures of the church there, so that when you hear about the work in João Pessoa, when you think about the work in Brazil, maybe you can at least have these snapshots in your mind and be more ready to pray for the Christians there in the work that they are wanting to undergo. I know there's something else I was wanting to say about our visas, but I'm drawing a blank on it right now. We have applied for our visas, and the Brazilian process seems a little bit backwards to me. We applied for our visas on May the 6th, and after a long, drawn-out process, the church in Brazil, it took them about four and a half months to get their documents in order and to be able to invite me to come to participate in the work. Once they got their documents done, then I applied for my visa after working out a couple of kinks there. I was able to apply on May the 6th, and after I applied, they told me that I needed to call in 4 to 6 weeks to find out if the visa is approved. They're the ones that approve it, but rather than them calling me and saying, your visa is approved, I have to call them, and if it's not approved, then I have to wait another week and I call again. If it's not approved, I wait another week and I call again. And we just keep going through that process. I have to keep calling them until it's approved. Visas are normally approved in 4 to 6 weeks, but they have been known to take as much as 6 months or so if there's any complications. We're not anticipating that, but we would solicit your prayers on behalf of the process. We've been anxious to get started in the work there, and would ask for your prayers that our visas may be approved soon. I intend to call the consulate for the first time. The 4 weeks will be up, or the month will be up, on this coming Thursday, I believe it is. And so if you could offer up any prayers between now and then on that behalf, I would appreciate it. If you have any other questions or interest in the Brazil work, please feel free to ask me about that afterward, or I'd be happy to provide my email address or phone number, snail mail address, and you can contact me at any point. I'm rather excited about the Brazil work. I think there's a lot of good things that can be done there and are being done there. I'm looking forward to being a part of that. And so I don't want to just go on and on, although I feel like I could do that about the work that's down there and the good things that are happening. But you have any questions that I've not answered that can aid you in knowing better the work, or perhaps stir an interest in somebody else going, like Tim and Lori did a few years ago, if somebody else has an interest in that, please get with me and I'd be happy to talk to you, or I'd be happy to talk to Tim and Lori again about that. Open up your Bibles, if you would, and we'll take a look at some scriptures now and hopefully make what I consider to be just some very practical applications about prison pillows. I don't know if you've ever thought about prison pillows or not. Think about them for just a moment. Would you imagine them to be very comfortable? Would you imagine that if you had a prison pillow to go to bed with at night, that you'd be able to sleep very good if it was a prison pillow? Probably not. I suspect that would be the case, that most of us would understand that if we were sleeping in a prison on a prison pillow, that would not be a good rest. I want us to think about what kind of rest that we get. And prison pillows will just be one application of that. But the psalmist says, David says in Psalm 59 and in verse 16, I will sing of your power, yes, I will sing aloud of your mercy in the morning. And that's what I want to emphasize to you tonight. I will sing aloud of your mercy in the morning, for you have been my defense and refuge in the day of trouble. The psalmist understood that when he got up the next day, he was going to be ready to sing praises to God. Now, I'm not going to ask for a show of hands. I'm not going to ask anybody to give any testimonials or make any confessions. But if we were to go around one by one and ask each person here, are you struggling with anything? Do you have any fears, any worries, any anxieties, anything that's troubling you? Perhaps you are wringing your hands about something and just kind of worried about how you're going to get through that. If you haven't experienced that, you're probably just really young. If you're not experiencing it right now, you probably will experience it fairly soon. At least you will face the situation. How you handle those worries and those difficult situations, hopefully we can talk about in the next few minutes. But every one of us, one time or another, are going to face difficulties. And the Scriptures encourage us to be able to sleep at night, to be able to rest, having put our trust in God. And that's what I want to talk about tonight, is hopefully helping us to be able to go to sleep tonight. I don't know if you have trouble sleeping or not, but this sermon helps me to be able to put things in God's hands. First off, I think one of the points that we can make is that God tells us to calm down. God tells us to calm down. I have a daughter who, I won't say which of the four, those of you that know my daughters probably will know which one I'm talking about, but I have one of my daughters who is just a very excited child. She is just a nonstop bundle of energy and likes to talk a lot, and when she gets excited, she just gets going. And you have to stop. Calm down, Naomi. Okay, I gave it away. We have to tell her, you just need to calm down. Slow, calm. Okay, breathe, okay? And she gets really excited about things, and she doesn't want to calm down. There's nothing wrong with that at all when it's appropriate time to be excited. But there are times in our lives where God is telling us to calm down because we've gotten all excited for the wrong reason. And in Mark chapter 4 and in verse 35 through 41, if you want to read along with me, on the same day when evening had come, he said to them, let us cross over to the other side. Now when they had left the multitude, they took him along in the boat as he was, and other little boats were also with him. A great windstorm arose, and the waves beat into the boat so that it was already filling. But he was in the stern, asleep on a pillow. And they awoke him and said to him, Teacher, do you not care that we are perishing? He arose and rebuked the wind and said to the sea, Peace, be still. And the wind ceased, and there was a great calm. But he said to them, Why are you so fearful? Why is it that you have no faith? And they feared exceedingly and said to one another, Who can this be that even the wind and the sea obey him? In this occasion, there are some what I consider remarkable events that transpire in these few verses here. The first remarkable thing is that Jesus goes to sleep during a storm. Whether he went to sleep during the storm or went to sleep before the storm, he is asleep during the storm. We read that in verse 38. He was in the stern, asleep on a pillow. Jesus was sleeping in the midst of this storm. It is common for people to have trouble sleeping during a storm. You hear the lightning, and you see the lightning, you hear the thunder, maybe the rain hitting on the windows or on the roof of your house, and sometimes that causes a little bit of alarm, and if the wind is really beating, perhaps you'll get up and make sure that no limbs are broken off of your trees around your house or something like that. But once you've realized that everything is okay, then you go on back to bed, and at least if you're like me, I sleep better during a storm. When the rain is falling down and I can hear that, it kind of just lulls me right back to sleep. But this was not just any storm. This was not just a casual storm. This was a ferocious storm. It was a storm so bad that the disciples are afraid. They're scared, and they wake Jesus up. They're so scared they cry out to Him, "Teacher, do you not care that we are perishing?" Now, in order to appreciate the fact that these disciples are asleep, remember who they are, at least some of them. In Mark 1, in verses 16 through 20, we read about Peter and Andrew and James and John, four of the disciples who were fishermen. These men would have been very accustomed to being out in the sea, being on boats, even during tumultuous times. This would not have been that big of a deal, except it tells us how bad of a storm it really was. Verse 37 says that it was a great windstorm. The waves are beating against the boat. And if you would put yourself in the disciples' sandals for a moment inside that boat, as the waves, you can feel the effects of the wind, and the waves are splashing over the sides of the boat, and you look down and your ankles are covered in water, and it's rising. The boat is filling with water, according to the end of verse 37. And so it is a very bad storm. It's such a bad storm that fishermen are afraid. Fishermen are afraid. And they cry out, "Teacher, don't you care that we're perishing?" I hesitate at saying that because I don't think that I do it justice. I'm almost afraid to quote the words of the disciples here in the tone that I suspect that they uttered them. They were probably crying and quite fearful. I can remember at times on the basketball court or on the football field when somebody would get hurt and maybe they would begin to cry and would say, "You're crying like a little baby. You're crying like a little girl," or something like that. And I suspect that on this occasion, without too much shame, these fishermen were crying like little girls or little babies. They were truly fearful for their lives. They say to Jesus, "Don't you care that we are perishing?" They thought that they were going to die right then. And so they are truly afraid. It is that bad of a storm. And so we might just wonder, how can Jesus sleep during a storm that is that bad? Well, when He wakes up, He calms the storm with just His words. His words are powerful. And He says, "Peace, be still." And everything calms down. So somebody may just assume that, Jesus has this power and He knows that He can stop whatever He wants to, whenever He wants to. And so that's how He was able to do that. But it's more than just this instance, because we see this being a part of Jesus' character throughout His life, even up through the garden and the prayers that He offered up there. And saying, "Not my will, but thine be done." He remained calm. Even during the roughest times of His life, Jesus was able to sleep and to be calm in the midst of difficulties. The difference between Jesus being able to sleep and the disciples not being able to sleep is found in the questions that Jesus asked His disciples. In verse 40, "Why are you so fearful? How is it that you have no faith?" He questions the disciples' faith. They were faithless at this point. And when I think about their situation and imagine myself being one of them, I ashamedly admit that I probably would have been just like them. Now, I know how to swim fairly well, but I don't ever anticipate being in a boat, in a little boat, in the middle of the sea, particularly in the middle of a storm in the middle of the sea. That's not something that I plan to ever do. Just the idea of being way out in the middle of a lake or in the middle of a sea knowing that I can't swim back even during good weather, but certainly not during a storm, that just gives me some fears that I don't know that I would be able to easily get over. The idea of going way out there gives me some problems. And so when I read this text, I'm not going to ever be in a situation, most likely, that I can make the literal application of not being fearful in a boat, in a storm. But I have had other situations that would be similar to that, I suspect, and that's where our challenge is in trying to make applications to Scripture. For example, in the flights that we make back and forth to South America, to Brazil, on different occasions flying, and somebody says, well, you're willing to fly, but you're scared of being in a boat. I understand that the idea of being 30,000 feet up in the air in a big piece of metal doesn't make a lot of people feel comfortable, but that really doesn't bother me. I don't know why. I guess it's because I don't understand any of it. I don't know why that big hunk of metal can stay up in the air. That doesn't. That's beyond me. It's beyond my intelligence. And so I just leave that. So I don't have to worry about it because I just don't think about it too much. But flying in an airplane doesn't really scare me like it does some people. But there have been some occasions where I found myself in similar situations to what we find right here in this text. With fishermen, with the storm being so bad that fishermen are afraid, and yet Jesus having the faith in the Father that He had that enabled Him to be able to sleep. On one such occasion, I remember rather vividly flying back from Brazil, and we'd flown from Sao Paulo to Miami, and I was by myself on this flight, other people, but nobody that I knew on the flight. And as I was flying back, we had some bad weather from Miami to from Sao Paulo to Miami. The next leg from Miami to Atlanta was the worst flight that I ever remember having in my life. We hit a storm that was the mother of storms, as far as I was concerned, in the air. And the plane was rocking back and forth and bouncing, and it seemed like it was just doing all kinds of flips and everything else. I know that it really wasn't, but it just seemed really bad. We'd hit those air pockets as we were flying along, and the plane would drop and raise back up. And I noticed that as we was going along, the stewardesses were just walking up and down the aisles, serving soft drinks and water and hot coffee. And I was just so fearful. I remember one time I looked down and I had grabbed hold of the armrest on each side of me, and I was just gripping them as hard as I could after one of those air pockets. And I realized that, you know, if the plane goes down, those armrests aren't going to do me any good at all. They're not going to help me. They're going to go down right with me. But there's something about just holding on to something that gave me a sense of protection. But then I noticed those stewardesses just doing their job, not being worried, didn't seem to be bothered about it at all. And I kind of became ashamed of myself. I thought, you know, you're supposed to be a man. What are these ladies are doing all of this work, and you're scared? And I kind of tried to bolster myself back up until we'd hit the next air pocket. And then I'd, you know what, I don't care. I'm going to be afraid. It doesn't matter. And then I realized, you know why they're able to keep on doing what they're doing? It's because they've flown for probably millions of miles. And they're very used to flying and during any kind of weather. And so that kind of consoled me in my manhood. I wasn't so much affected by that because I just reasoned that it's because they're used to it and I'm not. And as we were flying along, I had a little bit of fear in that. And then at one point in our flight, towards the end of it, we hit something. I guess it was a really bad air pocket or lightning bolt nearby or something. But that plane, it felt like it was going to take a dive. And I remember seeing one of the flight attendants, as she was walking down the aisle, she just quickly scooped up everything she had, ran practically to the kitchen area, threw everything into a cabinet, locked it up, ran over to her seat, plopped herself down, and threw on her seatbelt. And they've got these harnesses. It always seems unfair that the stewardesses have the better seatbelts. We just got the little lap belt. They got the full body harness. But she plopped down and she just sat there. And I thought to myself, now is the time to be afraid. If a stewardess is afraid, then I've really got cause for being afraid. See, it's the same thing here. If fishermen are afraid, you know it must be something really bad. But we made it through that storm, and we made it home, and made it safely, and no problems. But there are times in our lives, and you may have some similar situation of flying, or being in a boat, or being in a car in a near accident, or maybe even in an accident. Or you may not have even had to leave your home to have found something that really caused you to be afraid at some point. A very good friend of mine whose house burned down not too long ago. And, you know, there's just all sorts of things that could happen to people that could cause them to be afraid and have trouble sleeping. but we need to learn the lesson from the boat here. And think about those disciples as Jesus says, why were you fearful? How is it that you have no faith? And then make the application where in the airplane with me or wherever you're at, whatever it is that causes you fear, whatever it is that causes anxiety for you, your situation may be different than mine, but whatever it is, if the Lord is with you, if the Lord were with you physically at that moment and said to you, why are you so fearful? Why is it that you have no faith? How would you respond? See, the Lord wants us to trust Him. The Lord wants us to have the confidence. Jesus was able to sleep in the boat because He knew that the Father was taking care of Him. No matter what happens in that boat, the Father was going to take care of Him. And that's what we have to remember, is that God is going to care for us. But don't let this text, we're not going to turn from this text until we make sure that we make note that God allowed the storm to come upon the disciples. God allows storms to come into our lives as well. We need to think about how we're going to deal with them when they come. Fast forward for a little bit, though. Think about Peter and the other disciples in the boat. And then fast forward a little bit to Acts, the 12th chapter. I want to talk about an incident there in the 12th chapter of Acts. And focus the majority of the lesson here on narrowing down, focusing on the Apostle Peter. But the first two verses of Acts 12 say that now at about that time, Herod the king stretched out his hand to harass some from the church. Then he killed James, the brother of John, with a sword. And because he saw that it pleased the Jews, he proceeded further to seize Peter also. Now it was during the days of unleavened bread. So when he had apprehended him, he put him in prison, delivered him to four squads of soldiers to keep him, intending to bring him before the people after Passover. Peter was therefore kept in prison. A constant prayer was offered to God for him by the church. When Herod was about to bring him out that night, Peter was sleeping, bound with two chains between two soldiers, and the guards before the door were keeping the prison. Now behold, an angel of the Lord stood by him, and a light shone in the prison. He struck Peter on the side and raised him up, saying, "Arise quickly!" His chains fell off his hands. The angel said to him, "Gird yourself, tie on your sandals." So he did so. He said to him, "Put on your garment and follow me." So he went out, followed him, did not know that what was being done by the angel was real, but thought he was seeing a vision. When they were past the first and the second guard post, they came to the iron gate that leads to the city, which opened to them of its own accord. They went out and went down one street, and immediately the angel departed from him. When Peter had come to himself, he said, "Now I know for certain that the Lord has sent his angel, has delivered me from the hand of Herod and from all the expectation of the Jewish people." So when he considered this, he came to the house of Mary, the mother of John, whose surname was Mark, where many were gathered together praying. As Peter knocked at the door of the gate, a girl named Rhoda came to answer. When she recognized Peter's voice, because of her gladness, she did not open the gate, but ran in and announced that Peter stood before the gate. But they said to her, "You're beside yourself." And she kept insisting that it was so. So they said, "It's his angel." Peter kept continued knocking until they opened the door and saw him. They were astonished. But motioning to him with his hand to keep silent, he declared to them how the Lord had brought him out of the prison. So as we look at this account, and we'll stop there in the reading, but as we look at what has happened here, we see Peter and his time in prison. But before we see that, we see what leads up to that, and that is that James is killed. One of those fishermen, one of those disciples from the boat of Mark 4, one of the apostles, is killed. There have been other storms, if you will, figuratively speaking, already leading up to Acts 12. In Acts the 4th chapter, Peter and John, James's brother, Peter and John were arrested for preaching the gospel. In Acts 5, all of the apostles were arrested and beaten and threatened not to preach anymore. In Acts 8, a general persecution arises against all Christians. So all of them are scattered with the exception of the apostles. Stephen is murdered in that account, in that same text there. And now things are just going from bad to worse. More and more pressure is being put upon the Christians to the point where James, the apostle, is killed. Think about how that would affect you if you were Peter. Put yourself in Peter's sandals for a moment and think, how is that going to affect you? James has been killed. And then they grab you and they arrest you. Peter spends a night in jail. And think about how that pillow would have been. How well would have you been able to sleep? You know where I'm going with this text, I guess, in the 6th verse. It says, when Herod was about to bring him out that night, Peter was sleeping. How could he do that? says Peter was spending this night in jail and he's sleeping. I wonder, if that had been me, where would I be? I suspect that I wouldn't be sleeping, at least not very well. I probably would be going around from block to block in that jail cell, trying to find one stone that was loose that I might be able to push out and squeeze my way through to escape. Or I might be rattling the bars, saying, you know, give me my phone call. I know they didn't have phones back then, but you know the point. You know, I'd be wanting justice. I want my lawyer. I want to talk to somebody. I want my mommy. I want anything. There's a misunderstanding. No, let me clarify. Let me explain what I meant by that. I'd be trying to somehow, most likely, I suspect most of us would, not be sleeping very well, but we'll be trying to find some way to get out of there. But not Peter. Peter spends the night in jail sleeping. But notice what he says. Go back to verse 5. It says, Peter was therefore kept in prison, but, the New King James Version says, but constant prayer was offered up to God for him by the church. Now, while I'm wanting to talk tonight about your difficulties and your problems and the things that might cause you to not be able to sleep well at night and how we ought to learn some of the lessons from this, for pause that thought. We're going to come back to it. But for right now, I want you to think about other people. You've got problems in your life. You've got things that seem, what was the word that my daughter invented last week? Ginormous. That's gigantic and enormous, I guess. They just seem really, really big. And what we need to understand is that other people have those as well. And on this occasion, it was Peter's turn to have a big, ginormous problem. But you see what all the other Christians were doing? They had gathered together at Mary's house and they were praying during the night. Peter's over there in prison sleeping. But the Christians, and that's not the contrast. The contrast is between what Herod was planning to do and what the Christians were doing. That's where the battle's going on in this chapter. Herod is planning to kill him, but the Christians are praying for him. And you see who wins. We'll talk about winning in just a moment. But are there brothers and sisters of yours in Christ that are going through difficulties, having struggles, having problems, that they need your prayers? Someone once said that the way that we can measure our selfishness is in how much we pray for others. I don't want to have to admit where I would stand in that if somebody were going to measure me. We need to pray for each other more often. We talk about being New Testament Christians. We want to follow the New Testament pattern. One of the things that we need to understand is that following the New Testament pattern doesn't just mean partaking the Lord's Supper on the first day of the week, giving of our means as opposed to tithing, and making sure that we sing without an instrumental music. I don't mean to belittle any of those things. Those are all important. We need to make sure that we follow the New Testament pattern in them. But following the New Testament pattern is more than that. Following the New Testament pattern is finding passages like this where we see, well, in the first century, Christians that were struggling with something, other Christians got together and they prayed for them. That's following the New Testament pattern, is then we go out and we do that same thing. I mean this lesson to challenge you. Are there brothers and sisters who it would be good for you to call some Christians together? This doesn't mean that for every hangnail we need to break out the phone tree and assemble the whole congregation together and pray because somebody's got a hurt finger. But there are times where there are very real and very big problems in people's lives. And it is extremely appropriate, scripturally speaking, for Christians to band together, just like we find here in verse 5 and in verse 12 and 13, of Christians coming together. One of the things that I find interesting here is that when Peter finally woke up and realized that what was happening was real, he knew where to go. I wonder how he knew. There may be different possibilities. But what's the most likely reason of why Peter knew, I'm going to Mary's house?
I'm going over to where John Mark's mother lives. Why? I think the most probable reason is they have shown themselves to be that kind of people before. These are very likely a family who has opened up their house to Christians, to worship, and to study, and to pray. These are spiritually hospitable people. We know that from John Mark's life as time goes on, particularly by the end of Paul's life and his writing in 2 Timothy. John Mark was a useful man as well. But if you had had some really big problem, say for example, this probably won't happen, but it could. What if you're arrested for being a Christian? And finally, in the middle of the night, you're released. And you think, wow, this is amazing. I've got to go tell somebody about this. I know where I'm going. I'm going over to brother so-and-so's house or sister so-and-so's house because they're probably awake right now praying for me anyway. Do you see that happening here? That's what's transpiring. It would do us good to think about each other and what other people's problems are so that we can pray for them and at times gather together and pray for one another, just like what we're finding here. This is unlikely to simply be the regular Wednesday evening Bible study, and so they're together praying. They're praying specifically for Peter's situation. That's why they're together praying. That's a good application from this text, I believe. But then we see that Peter is awakened. Peter was sleeping so soundly that when the angel appeared, the light shining into the cell, and the angel has to jab him on the side and even helps him up. It says in verse 7, "Now behold, an angel of the Lord stood by him, a light shone in the prison, and he struck Peter on the side and raised him up, saying, rise quickly." It gives the impression that Peter is sleeping soundly. This isn't just a tossing and a turning and a restless sleep. I don't know what his sleep number was here, but he was sleeping good. He was not having any troubles, resting. Why? One of his best friends has just been killed. It looks very likely that he's going to be killed. There's no promise that he's going to be released. In fact, this could have appeared to Peter as the fulfillment of John 21. It wasn't, but it could have been, as far as Peter knew. Here he is, bound, going where he doesn't want to go. I don't know what was in Peter's mind. I don't need to suppose too far in all of that. But Peter was able to sleep. Because he had learned the lesson from the boat and from other times with Jesus. Having gone through and observed his master and his teacher, he has finally been able to put it into practice. In fact, that's the very definition of a disciple, is a practicing learner. That is the meaning of a disciple. Somebody who is not just learning facts, but is putting it into practice while he's doing so. And that's what Peter has done now. He has practiced the lesson from the boat. And then he tells us to do the same thing. If you fast forward into Peter's life later on, and in 1 Peter chapter 5 and in verse 7, Peter says, casting all your care upon Him, for He cares for you. Isn't he saying, calm down? Isn't 1 Peter 5 and in verse 7 saying, you ought to be able to sleep? Again, I said at the beginning that I don't know what your difficulty is. Maybe it's health problems. I just had I had breakfast a couple of months ago with a man who's in his 70s, just obeyed the gospel about 3 months ago, and was having breakfast with him one morning, and he's dying of cancer. He knows that he's probably not going to live very much longer. And while we were talking about his situation and mine and so forth, he made a comment about my family being a lovely family or being good kids or something to that effect. And I said, you know, I'm just so blessed. But I tell you, Bert, it makes me afraid. Because things are going so well for my family and we are so blessed that I'm just waiting for the other shoe to drop. I'm just waiting for some problem. It just seems like we've had it too good for too long, and something's going to happen. You know, it's kind of a fear in the back of my mind. And he says, it will. Thanks, Bert. That's not what I was wanting you to say. I was really wanting you to say, oh, no, you don't need to worry about that. But he didn't. He wasn't an over-optimist. He was a realist. And in everyone's lives, problems come up. Whether it's health problems like Bert's, or maybe it's financial problems. There are people who, either because of their own carelessness or maybe because of something beyond their control, they become unemployed or whatever, and they don't know how they're going to pay their bills. That's a very real problem for people. Or maybe it's parenting problems going one way or the other. Maybe you're having problems raising your kids. You don't know how they're going to turn out. You're worried about their future. You don't know, are they going to be faithful? Are they going to obey the gospel? Are they going to continue in service to God when they get out on their own? Maybe your kids are getting ready to leave for college sometime soon. And you worry about that. Or maybe it's going the other way. Maybe you're worried about your parents. Maybe their situation is such that causes you to be fearful. As my wife and I get older and our parents get older, we've realized that we have to look both ways, both towards our kids and towards our parents. And sometimes that causes us to be worried and to have some anxiety. I don't know what your problem might be tonight. Maybe I've not even touched on it. Maybe I've not hit on exactly what your situation is, where you're suffering, where you're anxious about something, or where you're being tempted to be anxious. What I'm saying is that whatever your storm is, whatever your prison cell is, this is what the Bible tells us to do. Psalm 59 and in verse 16, in the morning I will rise to sing praises of the mercies of God. God will carry me through the night, David was saying, because He's my defense and He is my refuge. God will take care of us. You might kind of wonder about that situation back there in Acts 12, but God didn't take care of James, did He? God allowed James to be killed. You know, it doesn't always work out, does it? Really? I wonder if you were to ask James and Peter on that day, who was the one better off? I suspect it would have been a unanimous vote. James went on to be with God. He's in the presence of the Lord. Peter still is continuing his fight. James didn't lose. Sometimes we forget that the idea of success, spiritual success, is not just physical survival. In fact, that has very little to do with it, physical survival. It is putting our faith and our trust in God so that whether we live or whether we die, we trust in God. And that's what these scriptures are teaching us to do. Tonight, if you're in the boat with the Lord, it doesn't matter how big the storm is, you should be able to sleep. If you're in a prison and you think of your life in some sort of, I'm locked up, I don't know how to get out of this, you know what? God will provide. Whether you live, whether you die, whether you become rich or whether you become poor, those things don't matter. But faithfulness to God does. You can trust the Lord and He will see you through. That is a promise from these scriptures and many, many others. Our problem is the same problem the disciples had, and that is when the waves are beating against us and as the water is rising in the boat, we forget the power that we have. Jesus says, peace, be still, to the problems of our lives. That doesn't mean that they're immediately solved when we become a Christian or when we pray. But they're taken care of to the point that we don't have to worry about them. One of the questions that we can ask of whether we are truly applying this principle of putting our trust, putting our faith in God, is whether we're able to sleep at night. The pharmaceutical companies are making millions of dollars a year selling drugs to get people to sleep. I'm not scripturally or spiritually opposed to those. If somebody has a physical condition that makes that necessary, I don't have a quarrel with you. But if your problem of going to sleep is because you're worried about things, don't go to a bottle. Go to the Lord. We need to put our trust in God. A pill bottle isn't going to solve those problems. We may sleep through the night, but we're not going to be ready to rise in the morning to sing of the mercies of the Lord. We're still going to have those same struggles. We need to put our confidence in God. Whatever problem you have tonight or tomorrow or next week or next year, I don't care how big it is, God is bigger. Now, I haven't always applied this. And I don't always apply it as well as I should. Gary Fisher was one of the first preachers to remind me that if I can't preach better than I can practice, I better get out of the business. Sometimes it's hard to put a lesson like this into practice. It's hard to remember what we ought to do when times are tough. I can remember one occasion when we lived in Brazil. It was in 1995. My family and I didn't travel into the city of Sao Paulo often because of the danger there. But as we were approaching the end of our stay, we decided to make a trip, a little bit of sightseeing combined with some buying of souvenirs and so forth. And while we were in downtown Sao Paulo, we were robbed. And it was kind of a duping. They tricked me into giving up my backpack. And when I realized that my backpack had been stolen, I, without even thinking, started chasing after the criminals. There was a gang of them, about six or eight, the police say. And I just took off after them. And I caught one of them. Didn't get my things back. But I caught one of them, and we went through the process. He went to jail and so forth. And when I got back home that night, on the way home even, began to think about, inside that backpack, I had a planner. And in that planner had my name and my address and my phone number. And it had where my Bible studies were and what time I was out of the house, where I was going to be at different Bible studies and so forth. It said everything about me. And I got to thinking that if this were a gang in the United States and I had sent one of their gang members to prison, that they'd come looking for revenge. And I got thinking, what in the world have you done? That was a pretty stupid thing to do, to run after them, you know, now that I stopped to think about it. And I became afraid. And I'll tell you, ashamedly, for 3 nights, I barely slept. Because a car would drive by in front of our house, and I'd be at the shutters looking out, seeing, are they stopping? Are they doing something to the house? I'd go out of the front gate to walk down to the bus stop, and I'd look to see if anybody was stalking the house, if anybody was casing out our house. Maybe they were going to cause some harm to my family while I was gone. But the whole time I was away from the house, I was afraid for my family's sake and for my own. The slightest thing disturbed me for 3 nights. Finally, I came to my senses and realized, after thinking about passages like Mark 4 and Acts 12 and 1 Peter 5 and in verse 7, that I was not doing what I had come to Brazil to preach. I was not practicing. If I'm going to be a proclaimer of the gospel, I've got to be a believer of it. And I had not cast my care upon the Lord. And so I made the decision that I don't care what happens, whether they come and get us or whether they don't. I need to be able to sleep. I need to be able to trust in God. Well, they ended up not coming, but that's not the point. That doesn't make any difference. Whether they had or whether they hadn't, we've got to trust in the Lord. And I'm sure that if we had the time, that each one of us that have lived very many years at all could reflect back on occasions where we've not slept well, because we've not put trust in God. We've tried to work through the problems ourselves as opposed to just turning it over to the Lord. Casting our care upon Him. He cares for us. And so Peter's telling us, learn the lesson from the boat. It took him a while to do it, but in the prison he did. And he's saying, learn the lesson from the prison. Learn from Peter. Tonight, do you have something that's causing you anxiety, that's causing you fear, causing you worry? We have problems in our lives, and we're not denying those problems. But God is bigger. And you can go to sleep tonight trusting in the Lord. And you can go to sleep thinking of Psalm 59 and verse 16, saying, I'm going to rise in the morning to sing of the mercies of the Lord. If only you will put your trust in Him. Now, perhaps tonight you find yourself not in the boat with the Lord. You've gone in a different direction. You need to come to Him. Jesus said, he that believes and is baptized shall be saved. How much He cares for us is that Jesus died on the cross to save us from our sins. And we simply need to come to Him on His terms. And if you've done that, but you've been trying to solve your problems on your own, you're wasting the opportunity, the blessings that God has to offer you. The Christian life is one where we can go to God with whatever cares we have, and He will take care of them for us. He will see us through. Tonight, is there something that we can assist you with? We talked about the need for Christians to pray for one another there in Acts 12. There are Christians right now that are ready to pray with you and for you. If we can assist you in any godly way, please come. All together we stand and sing.